You are listening to the Fire You Carry podcast. Today's episode is a reissue of our first episode with Tim Kennedy. It is our most popular, in other words, our most downloaded episode. It's an outstanding episode. If you've got kids in and around the area where you're listening, there is profanity in this and some difficult talk surrounding the subject of war, but it's a great one. If you have listened to it already, listen to it again, send it to a friend. We really appreciate the fact that you are here. Thank you for listening. Enjoy.
I know what it feels like to be part of the most elite task force on the planet, hunting the number one bad guy in Iraq. And I know what it feels like to get blown up and have my ass handed to me. That spectrum of failure to success, I don't think you can really appreciate what it feels like to be successful until you know what it feels like to fail. I don't want to be okay. I want to be the best. Just go and be a badass. You're opening with this? Ooh, this is where we're opening.
Yeah, I want to ask you if you will tell that story.
Or this is like the thing of nightmares.
Are you cool with that?
Of course.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's just horrible. Like, let's talk about like the depravity of humanity and like the most disgusting things that one human can
like
do to another human.
I probably should have prefaced this whole thing with, well, I was going to do it in there, but then I got distracted. We try to talk about real stuff and we're pretty open and honest about our struggles and things. So the depravity, the tough things, that's what we like to talk about.
Oh, great. I love talking about those things.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're just going to start right off with it.
I'm like unicorn and marshmallows. You know, like my farts smell like petunias.
Yes.
Okay. So mid-2000s, I'm in Afghanistan. I am a sniper that's attached to the coalition. So I'm not working with any other Americans. I'm working with a whole bunch of foreign special operation units. I'm on this mountain and I'm looking down into this valley. And at this valley, there's this tiny little village. And in rolls the Taliban. And I'm observing for this foreign special operations unit. So I have no authority and no Americans to be able to do anything. I have to observe. And then I relay what I'm seeing as accurately as I can. It's one of the cool things about being a sniper is everybody thinks it's like stealth ninja stuff. When it's really, I'm a coward hiding behind a rock, watching things happen and telling other people about it. So I'm in said coward position watching this village as the Taliban rolls in and they proceed to rape and murder everyone in the village.
Oh, my God.
And not even gender. I mean, this was like, you know, now in 2021, it's totally gender neutral. But back in like, you know, mid-2000s, you'd usually have a gender you would prefer to rape if you were the Taliban. Not with these guys. These are like, assert dominance over all of these. I mean, they're not even human.
Pure evil.
Yeah, it's pure evil, unadulterated evil. And, you know, the village gets massacred. And fast forward 6 weeks, another mountaintop, another foreign special operations unit. And I'm watching the same thing happen. I'm watching what is going to be a reenactment in real time, deja vu of my worst experience to date. And I've had some pretty horrible experiences up to that point, but this was a new low. Of the Taliban coming into a village. And so we were at these villages because we knew where the Taliban were and we were observing what they were doing and where they're going. If they're recruiting, is this like asserting dominance? So it's just trying to understand what the Taliban was doing is why we were there. And in comes the Taliban to this next village. And it's like, it's going to happen again. I'm going to sit here.
Not again.
I'm going to watch for hours and hours on end. You know, like, oh, just not, don't look down your scope. You're literally paying me to look down my scope. Like I'm there to see what they're doing. The anxiety, the anticipation, I don't know what the right word is. The horror of knowing what was coming, because I know firsthand what this looks like. And there's no way I'll ever describe what that looks like to anyone because it's horrible. Then out walks an old woman, an old man. They look about the same when they're in Afghanistan and they're in the 70s. First of all, when you're a 70-year-old Afghani, you're a badass.
Because you've lived that long.
Yeah.
You've been through 70 wars.
The Russians, the French, the Americans, the Taliban times 10. And they had like an 18-something muzzle-loaded breech-action rifle. they cracked a round off at the Taliban as they're coming down the one road into the village. And I don't know if that ball, I won't even call it a bullet, hit one of those vehicles or if it hurt somebody, but it looked pretty good. Like muzzle alignment was definitely there. I don't know what the sight picture was, but it looked in the general direction of a good shot. And the Taliban, one old, we'll just assume a 70-year-old woman that was the grandma of somebody in the village, took this rifle, shot it at the Taliban, and they disappeared. Like a fart in the wind. From a 70-year-old woman with a breech-loaded muzzle rifle. We had better stuff when we fought the British in 1776. Yeah. But it was absolute fearlessness on her part of, even if they were going to come in, she was going to get it worse than everybody else, and she didn't care. But there is a chance that she could have stopped it, and she did. They like dispersed and kind of like surrounded and waited, and then they went back over the ridgeline and they hung out, and then they never came back. Like, I don't know what their plan was, but one woman with a rifle, they're like, there has to be another village without one, so I'll just go to the next one. The fearlessness, the bravery, and the courage of a feeble 70-year-old woman in Afghanistan.
That's absolutely amazing. And I think the cool thing about that is that old woman probably knew that was going to be the last thing that she was ever going to do, and that it was going to go bad, because I'm sure they had heard, they know what the Taliban does, right? They know why they're coming there. They know they're not coming to distribute food or medical supplies or anything. But she had that bravery in that moment to say, no, I'm going to do the one thing I can do. I'm going to do the best I can. And it worked out for them, which is amazing. But she had that courage to do it, even though she probably thought, this is my last day on earth and it's about to get horrific.
Yeah. What is your last act going to be?
Yeah.
Can you choose that? And we the bravado of men saying, I'm going to die in a pile of brass.
Yeah.
Are you?
Yeah.
You're not. Because most people in the face of the oncoming onslaught of true carnage, everybody cowers. Like, I mean, the most trained, badass people in the world I've seen hide behind tires and underneath Humvees. And I remember when we got blown up, I was like burrowing like a prairie dog into the ground to get some form of cover, because we're in this valley and we're just getting owned. And I'm like, is this cowardice or is this me trying to survive as I'm burrowing my way into the ground, right?
It's just fight or flight,
right? Yeah. Is that the bravado that I'm talking about? Or like, was I... we ended up slain. But in the moment, I was scared to death. And then I see this woman with that shoulder rolled forward from age of carrying things her whole entire life, her skin that looks like leather, that's paper thin, though, as she takes a musket and shoots at the Taliban.
And so what is...
More than likely, she was terrified herself, but she still chose to act.
Yeah.
What is that, though? So she's not trained. She hasn't lived your life where you've done nothing but train your whole life. Now, granted, she did grow up in Afghanistan and make it to 70, so that is different. But where do you find that as a 70-year-old woman at the end of your life? Does it come from love of your family who's there? Is it just a defiance of, I'm tired of these guys? Where do you think that comes from?
I love the word defiance that you just used there. Have you seen the photo in Berlin?
Yes.
Where there's 500 Germans standing there and they're all doing the Hitler salute. And there's one guy that is like back as perfectly straight as if he was a professional dancer from Juilliard. His arms crossed defiantly again across his chest. And you could have walked up and told him that you're about to burn him alive if he didn't do the Hitler salute, and he would have stoically not moved an inch. So defiance, is that a single moment? Or is that a lifetime of choices leading up to that, where when you make that decision, there's nothing to deter you from that thing, that drive, that determination, that single modality of focus that's unfazed by anything that's going on? I think it's a contributing factor of millions of little decisions that lead up to that moment.
Absolutely.
Where it's like, I don't give a fuck. You can't do anything. You can't break me. Because to get here, you don't know what it took for me to be here. But now that I'm here, my grandchildren are behind me. You'll have to step over my dead body to get to them.
If you haven't seen that picture, we're going to put a link up to it. It's a really moving photograph if you know what's behind it. The fascinating thing about that photograph is that may have been the last picture that guy was ever in.
It absolutely was.
He probably died later that day.
Not a great way either.
No. And I actually read a book recently about Dietrich Bonhoeffer, you know, Dietrich, you know, his story.
Yep.
There's a point in that book where he's at a cafe with his friend, they're pastors in Germany, and something happens on the news. And so everybody's standing up and doing Heil Hitler and everybody's celebrating it. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer stands up and joins in. And his pastor buddy is just disgusted and like, what are you doing? Like, that's not our cause. We're fighting this. We're trying to kill this guy. They're in the middle of planning how to assassinate Hitler. And after they sat down, Bonhoeffer explained to him, he's like, well, if I go out right now by not doing the salute, I cannot continue my mission, which right now is to kill Hitler. And so for me, that's the bigger fight. And so in that moment, he's making a different decision where he's actually compromising, I would say, his morals and his values by participating in this worshiping, essentially, of Hitler. But he's got a bigger goal. So where do you draw that line? You know, obviously the guy in the crowd was drawing it right then and there, and it was the right thing to do.
Yeah. I mean, from Hitler's perspective, you know, he was still doing the greater good.
Right.
So he was compromising some degree of his morals in eugenics as he's going to eradicate the earth from not deserving genes. Like, let's get rid of these group of people because we don't want them to pass on their genes. So he, in his mind, he's rationalizing and justifying genocide. So there is a very fine line from like the Hitler of the greater good. Could you cure some diseases from eugenics? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Like, could we get rid of Down syndrome with selective breeding? Yes. Does that mean that we're going to go and kill everyone that has a chromosome that they're not supposed to? No.
No.
Do it and you're going to step over my dead body trying to get to my nephew who has Down syndrome. And that spectrum of what am I going to compromise for the right thing, or at what degree am I going to be so resolute that I will not bend, I won't cower, I won't break, I won't shatter, I won't do anything besides stand my ground. I don't know what that, and I think with every issue, there's a spectrum.
Yeah, and it's going to be different depending on who you are, what your position is in the world, and where you're at in your life right then. But you are going to have to come up against that decision point, and you're going to have to decide, am I going to stand, or am I going to step aside and let this horrible thing happen?
Yep.
So this morning you put us through a horrendous workout.
Brutal.
You called it the acid bath.
The acid bath.
Yes.
I know that you choose to put yourself into uncomfortable situations. Tell me why.
The process of the refiner's fire. We're actually surrounded by some pretty rad weapons.
True.
We've got a tomahawk over there. We have a battle axe right there. There's a warhammer right there. Those are like traditionally Norse forged battle axes and warhammers. We have a boar spear over there.
You need a shillelagh. Are you Irish?
Yeah.
We got to get you a shillelagh.
Are those just arbitrarily picked up out of the dirt? No, they came from the dirt, right? Like, that was ingredients that were then heated and put into a clump and then tortured. They're literally tortured. To make that axe right there, that material was tortured over an extended period of time so that the final product would be something that could serve a purpose. That's an inanimate object that doesn't have a soul and doesn't have a brain. But we're forged in, I believe, a similar way. And if you have a purpose, and if you have a reason that you know that you're here, how do I voluntarily choose to put myself through this torture so that I can be the best tool, the best device, the best person to serve and fulfill that purpose? So that's why I do it, is because there's no other way, and you know this, there's no other way to hone the body and the mind like pain.
Yeah, there's a book that I'm listening to right now called The Comfort Crisis, and he argues that because we live in a 72-degree house and go into a 72-degree car and go into a 72-degree office, is that our mind is not, it's not there. We're meant to be chased by a lion or a buffalo or whatever. And because of that, then our mind will create trauma, first-world problems.
Yeah.
And he theorizes that we need to expose ourselves to pain, the elements, nature, to get back into our natural self. And I think that it's been true in our lives. We haven't seen what you have seen, but we do see some trauma at work. And one of the reasons, the way we deal with that is by working out hard, is by going in the ice bath, is by doing challenging things. And I think it just gets the demon out of you. I think it gets you back to your natural self.
Yeah.
I
mean, you're walking in on a call and there's blood all over the floor and there's three people that, who knows what caused the carnage, but you have to save life. And your heart rate starts elevating, your respiration start increasing, and you're making split second decisions that are going to determine how these people live. And if you don't physiologically know what your increased heart rate and increased respirations feel like and your ability to make decisions in that moment, do you think you're going to perform better in that moment compared to somebody that trains? Of course not. No. So if I do the hardest thing that could happen to me in a day by choice and I design it, what else can happen to me in the next 12 hours that I'm working today that could get close to what I just put myself through? There's nothing. You know, I got 25 emails that are like must decide decision brief type emails with a variety of businesses, military, special forces things that are happening the moment that you leave that I have to network for the next 5 days. Those are easy. They're easy because I already did the hard stuff by choice.
Is that a mindset that you built in the military?
I mean, I think it was refined in the military. Like they put the reason why behind all of this stuff. But my dad was a real high level athlete and my mom's brilliant. And we grew up in a household that was high, high performers. And we jokingly, people are like, if you're not an attorney or an Olympic athlete in the Kennedy household, like you just need to walk off a cliff. And like the line for Sparta, they would have thrown us off cliffs if you weren't.
This is Kennedy.
Yeah, exactly. You're lame. You're like, oh, you fought for two world titles, Tim. Like, how did that go? I lost. I mean, I'm not a world champion. I'm like the two-time loser. Oh, okay. So we're going to have to take your last name back.
Not good enough.
Not good enough.
So you're super disciplined, obviously, and it shows. And you push yourself in the fitness realm super hard. Do you think that you can be a good husband? Can you be a good father? Can you be a good whatever your job is if you're not doing those things?
No. I think you are a better version of everything when you are the best version of yourself. I pity people looking for these comfort solutions, the easy buttons to problems, when usually the easiest way to solve some pretty serious interpersonal problems, like relationships as a husband or a father, how you perform at work, is that discipline and that regimen that you're going to put yourself through. Are you the best husband if you're this fat, lazy slob that's depressed and that can't perform in bed?
No,
you're not.
No.
That's eating crap food, that doesn't even know what real food looks like, that's not going to go hunt to provide for your family, that all of the different things that you can do to be a better version of yourself so that then when you walk into the house, you're barrel-chested, just jacked shoulders, a thick neck, and your wife's like, that's my man, you know?
And I think guys, they rationalize it because they say they want to maximize every ounce of time that they have with their wife and kids. And so they'll forgo going their own pursuits and doing their own things. I do think you have to, at least an hour, you got to give to yourself and I don't know if you call it selfish or whatnot, but you have to do that to be a better husband and a better father, I think.
Yeah. So we'll look at my day to day. Normally, I have an hour to an hour and a half of work before I go and start cooking breakfast for when the kids wake up. Then kids wake up. I have breakfast with them every single morning that I'm here. And then we take them to school. Then I go and train. I don't miss a moment. And oftentimes my wife will come with us and we'll work. She'll like do her own thing because she doesn't want to work out with us. And she thinks my programming is from Satan. But
it might be.
It is.
But we're together and don't miss a moment. And then the kids come home from school. I'm here. You know, like when I'm in Texas, the moment they come home, the rest of my work I'm going to be doing here. So like, if you want an appointment with me, if you want to train, if you want to go shoot, if we're going to do content, if I have to do meetings at the military base, like that's going to happen between 8:30 and 2:30. And then I'm here and I schedule all of my appointments and podcasts and lay all my work to happen so I can be with them.
Talk to me real quick about just the kids' perspective. So having kids, why would fitness be important just specifically for the kids?
Yeah. It makes you better at everything. So I watch dads at a restaurant when they get frustrated with their child and they lash out. You know, I told you to sit your butt down, boy. I pity that guy. You know, I look at him. I feel sorry for him. I look at his wife not looking at him, and everything about the chemistry, everything about the interaction between the family is broken. And it's because of him. Not even like the cool stuff of me being able to go onto the lacrosse field with my son and be able to like smoke all of the coaches. And they're like, who is this dude? And he's never played lacrosse before.
He's 42 and runs a 4.5.
Yeah. And my son looking at me with the same admiration and appreciation of that's my dad. And then like, of course, the life-saving element of it where the car is going too fast and doesn't even get close to slowing down at the crosswalk. And I'm able to like pick my son up and flip the car over at the same time. Like, that's a handy life-saving and life-taking ability comes from fitness.
Yeah.
Like the most elite units on the planet, from SEAL Team 6 to Delta Force to Ranger Regiment to the Green Berets. If you're going to try and find a commonality in a little Venn diagram in the center of it, that center of gravity is going to be fitness.
Yeah. So if we're talking to a dude sitting over there on your couch that is in a place right now where he couldn't be at your level where you're at right now, what would you say to him about where he should start?
I am no different than that guy on the couch. First of all, I have pain. I have aches. I have thoughts of failure. There's nothing that's going to go through his head that's not going to go through mine. There is no stoic superhero that never looks into the face of adversity and it's like, this is going to be easy. You know, like they look at me like, this is going to be rough. So first know that there's no difference between that person that you admire and yourself. The ultimate difference is that they make that choice to do something about it. And it's going to be 1%. If you can improve 1%, you know, if you can't run around the block, walk it. And then after a couple of weeks, you'll be able to run it. And then once you can run it, try to run 2 blocks. And then you can run 2 blocks faster. Then do it twice. And then like that 1%, that incremental discipline and that regimen is the thing that will turn the corner. You know, when people ask, hey, can you give me advice on fitness? What I tell them is give me 30 days of journaling your diet. Do I journal my diet?
I doubt it.
I don't. I absolutely don't.
But you've been a lifelong athlete. Yeah, right.
Yeah, but am I disciplined in it? And what I'm asking from them is discipline. I'm asking them to prove to me that they're going to have the discipline in the small things, that 1%. Then it's easy. Bro, here's a program. You know, download 4-Pillar Fitness. Every single day you'll have a free workout. And if you want some intense programming that me and Juan are going to design, you can go and get it. Plug and play. But first, prove to me that you can be disciplined. Otherwise, I'm not wasting my time. Sit on the couch and die.
There's got to be a buy-in.
Yeah.
So you mentioned failure. How do you deal with failure? I know that you've been wildly successful and that you are doing great.
I got to ask you this because I'm a fight fan. And so I remember we all pulled for you in the UFC because here it was an American hero that was in the UFC. A lot of these guys, you know, they came from different backgrounds. And I remember distinctly, you know, we all had 30 guys that would come on a couch and watch and get the fight together. And the Yoel Romero fight.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
And it was like Stuhlgate, but you had him and you had him down. And I think that you were undefeated at the time. And it was like he was coming up, Tim was coming up, and it was looked like he was going to fight for the belt. And then that whole drama after the second round, and then he got you in the third round. But I want to say is how do you transition the mindset from that going, riding the wave up of the UFC and almost fighting for the title or whatever it might be, to transitioning? How do you go into that? Because I think that can make you or break you.
Yeah, I'm going to put some gravitas to that specific fight. So 2 fights before that, I fought Michael Bisping.
Yeah.
And
you won, right?
Oh, I absolutely destroyed him. 25 minutes of brutalizing and humiliating him. There was a moment in the third round where Greg Jackson, my corner, was like, why don't you just finish him? I'm like, I want to hit him for another 10 minutes.
Bisping was kind of a punk back in the day.
He still is a punk. But yeah, back then he was an extra special punk. And we had some pretty rough chemistry. He had spit on one of my friends and he would illegally need a downed opponent, Jorge Rivera, in a fight that he was and he laughs about it and jokes about it. Yeah, I won that fight. He's just not a great person. An amazing fighter. And a fighter that has the fighter's heart. But like as a person, I was like, man, I'm really looking forward to beating him up for 25 minutes. So in the Yoel Romero fight, Michael Bisping is now the middleweight champion. His last loss was to me. And I am the number two contender fighting the number one contender. So this wasn't just, I'm fighting Yoel Romero. The winner of this fight is going to fight for the title. And the dude that just beat the champion is Tim Kennedy. And I brutalized him. So this win is me. I'm going to go fight for the UFC middleweight title. And I'm fighting a guy that I'm going to dismantle on live television to get the UFC title. And then, of course, Stuhlgate happens. I start celebrating and I find out that the fight's not over.
For those that don't know,
yeah, explain that to
us. After the second, Tim had him basically knocked out. He was saved by the bell and then he did not get off the chair. He did not get off the chair. So you have a 1 minute break and he did not get off the chair for various reasons. So which means that would typically end the fight, correct?
Yeah. The way the athletic commission rules read, you have 10 seconds to answer the bell, regardless of the cause. I know rules because operating within the confines of the rules are an important part, both in everything that I've ever done and in fighting. So when the bell rings and he's still sitting there and I'm like, yeah, this is rad. Here we go. And he doesn't get up. You know, like I can keep track to the second of 5 minutes. I could pretty much count to 10. And
it was way longer.
Yeah. So he doesn't answer the bell and I start celebrating. Mouthpiece comes out.
Fight's over.
Like, by the rule, fights are over. I'm with my corner. I'm pointing to Dana White being like, you're paying me for this fight and you give me that title fight because I'm going to put Michael Bisping in the dirt for forever. Then like 40 seconds later, he stands up and, my headspace could not be further from fighting. I'm thinking about after parties and my wife walking into the after party. It's going to be a great night. And then I get TKO'd a couple of minutes later. Absolutely a bummer, you know, but, to answer the question about failure and the riding that high and then taking it down to the low. I love contrast. I know what it feels like to be standing there and watching somebody have their hand raised. That's not your hand, right? And they're going to their after party and they're having a great night and I'm sitting there. I know what it feels like to be part of the most elite task force on the planet, hunting the number one bad guy in Iraq. And then I know what it feels like to get blown up and have my ass handed to me. That spectrum of failure to success, I don't think you can really appreciate what it feels like to be successful until you know what it feels like to fail.
Absolutely.
And I rush to failure. Do I ever want to fail? No. Do I ever want to lose? No. I mean, you saw me on my last rep of our acid bath today where my foot comes off the pegs as I'm trying to beat Shane's new 13-second 15 calories on the assault bike. And I mean, I'm like in it and I failed. You know, like I came off, I made a mistake, but I was putting everything in it, not to use those annoying analogies of like, you know, Michael Jordan missed how many 3-point shots at the buzzer or how many times did Babe Ruth strike out, you know, but like the whole idea around all of that is they push themselves to failure and to fail. Ultimately, they became the best, the GOATs, the greatest of all time in their respective categories.
Because you learn more from failure, right? You learn.
Absolutely. So we do AARs in the military, an after action review. And the two things, the two categories are sustain. That's things that we did right that we want to continue to do. And then we have improves. And improve is that didn't go well. We need to change something so that thing that didn't go well goes better next time. Hopefully moves into the sustain category. I argue that the sustains are almost discounted. Everybody looks at the improves. Everybody looks at what did we do wrong that we could do better. And there's a reason for that. It's because in that failure, in that, man, we lost a dude. I'm never going to make that mistake again. When that RG rolled over into that culvert in Afghanistan and all those Green Berets died, we made a bunch of changes. No Green Beret ever died again inside one of those vehicles. Like we had to go to this mandated training and we changed a whole bunch of mechanical things on. Like that is an improve, right? We learned through failure what that looks like. It's like, why wouldn't you do that in your personal life? And why wouldn't you do that in your professional life? And why wouldn't you do that with your relationships?
Well, and you're never going to find those moments to learn from if you're not pushing yourself. If you're just trying to live the mediocre, comfortable life, you're never going to find those points, which means you're never going to have anything to improve on. There's not going to be really anything to work on. I mean, there's a lot to work on, but you're not going to be aware of it because you haven't failed.
Mediocrity and comfort. Like they disgust me. Like they viscerally make me, like, you could see me getting agitated here. They're the worst things that a person can do, is to be comfortable and to be like comfortable in your marriage. It's not going to go well. To be comfortable with you at work, it's not going to go well. It's like to be comfort, to be that I don't want to be okay. I want to be the best. And have you ever had champagne at room temperature?
A long time ago.
It's disgusting. It's disgusting, yeah. Right? How about lukewarm tea?
Tea's gross anyway, but yeah, it's gross.
Yeah, it should be in the harbor. Good answer. coffee served at a nice balmy 80 degrees.
Bad.
Disgusting, right? Maybe some curdled milk that's at room temperature. Does that sound good? Yeah, like they're supposed to be in the spectrum, like extreme perfection and disgusting mediocrity. Like, is hot milk good?
Yeah.
Is cold milk good?
Yeah.
Is lukewarm milk good? No.
You know, horrible, like, yes.
So it's disgusting. So, well, like, just do it right.
Well, it seemed like, obviously, from the teams and everything else, you've surrounded yourself, even in your personal life, it seemed, with, like, very high caliber dudes. Those dudes were savages. And then in walks the door, two of the best grapplers in the world.
Yeah.
And so you're talking about young men. We have a lot of young guys that are coming up and stuff like that. I know I'm a better person because I hang out with Noel. And is that something that you've designed in your life, that is that something conscious that you say, I'm always going to be around high caliber people that push me?
Pieces of shit will ruin your life. Like, they'll just drag you down. They're anchors in everything that you're going to do. Every success that you could have, one person giving you wrong advice, one person saying, you can't do it, it's not worth it, don't think about it, you're not good enough, you're not strong enough, you're not fast enough. That one person could neuter any chance of success. So why have them there? Like, I don't want to be the fastest in the room. I don't want to be the strongest in the room. I don't want to be the best grappler in the room, but I'm going to try to be the best in that room all the time. And I'm going to surround myself with people with that shared purpose, with that shared desire, with that same goal and that same drive. Whether they're entrepreneurial successes, they're philanthropic, they're just wicked smart at business that I can, like, leech off of them. You know, like, you know, we're talking afterwards, like, that the 20, 30 minutes after those workouts, when I'm surrounded with these incredibly successful men, and I'm like, all right, so I have to get an occupancy permit from the city, and here are the things that they're doing, that it's going to cost me about $100,000. How do I circumvent that? And they're like, this is so easy. Let me answer this petty question that's not even worth my time. But this is what you do, Tim. I'm like, oh, thank God. In everything, in every category, I try to be, you know, you are who you surround yourself with. So why wouldn't you surround yourself with success?
But those are reciprocal relationships too, though. You're not just sitting there taking from these men. You're also giving.
Well, I have to earn my seat at that table.
Absolutely. Because you have, obviously, a lot of expertise, a lot of intelligence. You bring a lot to the table as well. So it's not a one-way street.
No. I mean, but like, if I say, if I fell off the wagon, and am I going to fail at things? Have I failed at businesses? Yes. Have I failed in my personal life? Absolutely. And I have friends, Shane and Rob, that would stand with me even in those failures. Yes. But if they didn't see that want, that desire, that drive to improve and to turn from that failure, I don't know if I'd have a seat at that table. Like, would I be invited to sit down in that chair and put on the Normatex and have that conversation over a Topo Chico with these guys if I was just a failure and a loser and a failure and a loser and a failure and a loser? No. Rob would be like, hey, man, the gym's closed today. It's like, I gotta keep that edge sharp.
There's a couple things I'd love it. You were talking about that duality. And I've seen, we were in your house. I've seen you. You could be considered one of the baddest dudes on the planet. But I've also seen you as a girl dad, giving the kisses, we're playing the games, doing the things. And I think that's great, because I think too many guys that are coming up that are peacocking and trying to be something say that they're either a badass or they're either soft. And I don't think that's necessarily true. And I think that you've become a cultural leader of men in a weird time in our society that shows that you can absolutely be a 100% savage human being, but also be a present and wonderful father to girls.
Yeah, well, I'd put on a tutu right now, go out there and have a tea party with my finger raised as I sip the tea that my one-year-old makes me. Absolutely, right? If somebody walks through that door to touch my one-year-old, I'm going to take his face off. I'm going to wear his skin as a birthday suit for the rest of the year. And those two things coincide and can coexist, and they're not mutually exclusive. Matter of fact, I think they're complementary. So you can be the most loving, caring, compassionate husband on the planet. You can be the best dad in the world, and you can be an absolute brutal barbarian savage at everything that you do, to conclude fitness and violence. There is no such thing as a weak man that can be a protector. That's just a weak man, right? A good man is a man that is skilled and capable of violence, that chooses to be compassionate and kind. The other one is just a coward and useless to me. But that strong man that can touch his daughter with tenderness and care, and that can pick his son up and be a strong, masculine example of success, like, that's beautiful. The other thing, that's vestigial. Cut that shit off. It's like a nipple on a dude. I don't need it.
So our podcast is called The Fire You Carry. And what we're looking for when we talk to guys like you is, what is that? What is that fire that's inside of you that's driven you to be where you're at? So if you had to sum it up into one or two things up to this point in your life, what would you say that fire is for you?
Yeah, two things. Being in a guest 10, 11, and losing a wrestling tournament and having my dad, he was not ashamed. And dad, I love you. But the expression on his face when he saw me do so bad, he knew I was so much better than that. But he saw me underperform. He saw me crack and break mentally and lose in a match that there's no reason I should have lost. And I'm going to use the word shame. And that recognition of that external, you're better than that. And I consciously, in that moment, made a choice to not try my hardest. And because of that, the ripple effect of my mom being like, it's okay, like, her placating, Let's go get some ice cream. You're like, let's help you feel better. I'm like, this doesn't feel good. Like, this is humiliating. You know, like, my dad not making eye contact with me for like a few minutes as he's trying to rally to be an encourager. Like, I saw it. You know, I may have been 10, but I understood that.
They're cognizant, you know.
Yeah. Those kids know, man.
Yeah. They're more aware than we give them credit. Right.
That drove a lot of specific weaponized energy and everything that I did moving forward. Like, how were you an EMT at 18? How were you at the fire department at 18? Why did you go to the police academy exactly at 21? Why are you in graduate school at 20? Like, what was going on? And it was that same kind of focused energy. That was one. Two is, by 2007, I couldn't write down the names of my friends that had died. I just couldn't remember them all. I stopped going to funerals in 2007 because I would forget which one is coming up next. Because sometimes, like, even if a guy had died earlier, but he got shipped home sooner, but then they waited to set up the memorial for like a week, and then somebody that had died actually further, like, sooner than that. I walked in to the JFK Chapel where we do the memorials for the Green Berets, and I was like, I'm here for the wrong dude. Like, I mean, that wow. Like wrecked me. And I mean, I have pulled the trigger more times than I know. And all of that had to have been for a reason. Like, there had to be a purpose of why we had sacrificed so much, and like, why my friends, all these purple hearts and amputees. And, you know, like, as one of my friends just committed suicide this morning, wherever he is, like, I love him and his family. There has to be a reason why all of this has happened. And now, at this point in my 40s, I have weaponized that fear and I've weaponized that pain to be a motivator, where I'm not going to be the weakest on the team. I'm going to be the strongest. I'm not going to be the most unprepared. I'm going to be the most prepared. I'm going to understand tactically and strategically from a command element exactly what do I need to do to be the best leader I can be within this group. And that is, I'm taking what could be emotional baggage and I'm weaponizing it and turning that into the motivator.
As fuel.
I'm going to eat that pain. I'm going to eat that suffering, and it's going to fuel me. It's funny. My buddy Shane, he always jokes. He's like, that guy, he feeds off of pain. And you'll hear Wes Whitlock tomorrow. He has a saying. He always says, like, when all these people are suffering, Tim feeds off of it. And it's true, because that's what I feed on for me, my own suffering. So you can pile it on because you're just going to motivate me. You're going to be mean to me. You're like, you're going to troll me on Instagram. You're feeding the machine. Do you understand that?
So that's obviously driven you to where you are, which is awesome. You've got a great family. You've got a ton going on in your personal life. You're successful in the military. Do you feel like those traits, those driving forces have ever been a detriment to your life personally or professionally?
Oh yeah. Yeah, for sure. You know, like, how do you balance, how am I directing all of this energy? Like, and if I'm being selfish and I'm directing exclusively professionally and my relationships are suffering because of that. And that has happened in my life where I was so focused on, you know, being in the right country at the right time, hoping to hit at the right rebellion, you know, or and then neglecting other things that I should be focusing some of that energy towards. So I have failed in a variety of ways, but even with that failure, repurposing that energy to not make that same mistake and to apply the same discipline and regiment that I would use for my professional career in the military or my professional career as an entrepreneur or my professional career, insert whatever next, into my personal life. Can I use that same discipline, motivation, and energy in that regiment in my relationships as I do with everything else?
So I want to shift gears a tiny bit. We were at Mighty Oaks about 3 years ago together, and I saw you do something really cool that you probably don't even remember, but you had a watch on at the beginning of the week, and I believe it was a 511 watch, one cool military thing with a canvas strap. And at some point during that week, you gave it away to one of the guys there. And I watched what that meant to him and how much it impacted him. That it was really cool. It was a blessing for him. It was like, oh wow, Tim Kennedy gave me his watch. I think it's easy. I mean, I'm not in the same place, but I think it's easy when we have things that we're blessed with to forget that there are people around us that we can use those things to bless also. And I think a lot of times I've watched you do it in that instance, and I know you do it 1,000 other ways throughout the day.
He's doing it to us right now.
Yeah, you're doing it to us right now, having us in your home, letting us work out with you. We're podcasting with you. Like, that's a huge blessing for us. And I think it's awesome that you recognize that you've been blessed, right? You've worked really hard to get where you're at, but really, honestly, you've been blessed. And you have a lot to give, and you don't forget that there are others around you that some of that stuff is maybe actually not for you. It's to bless other people with, and to be available and to be generous with your time as much as you can and with whatever resources that you have. And you don't have to be a Tim Kennedy to do that. Like, we all have the ability to do that wherever we're at, because we're always surrounded by people that are in a different circumstance, whether it be financial or they're going through something personally. And just being aware of that, I think, is a really powerful tool that can not only better the lives of those around you, but will also better your life as you're generous with that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, the more you have, the more you can give, but for some reason, the more you have, the less you give.
It gets harder.
I don't know why is that? I'm not like a big, like, Bible throwing dude, but the parable that Jesus used about the poor beggar giving the penny that she had, and that was all that she had, and how valuable that penny was compared to the rich man that just gave, you know, like the 10%. And it was because it was out of the heart of giving that woman gave.
It wasn't the amount.
It wasn't the amount. Yeah. It was the effort. Like, we're not going to talk about what I give, but what I do is, there's a great book called Fields of Gold, and it challenged me to, what is the purpose of what I have here? Am I going to take that gun safe with me to death? You know, no. Does it serve a purpose for me right now? Yes, because I use the stuff in it for the things that I do for a living that provide money for me to be able to do extraordinary things, like philanthropically with veteran community specifically and within my church. And I can't do those things without some of this stuff. So they're cogs in a wheel to a degree, but the wheel that is rolling and the wheel that I have to keep turning is the wheel of giving. Nobody knows what I do or the lives that the purpose of where that wheel is going, but there's a very specific, I could draw it on that dry erase board. Matter of fact, I bet it is still on there where Justin and I, when we're like, okay, what is the point of what we're doing right now? Like, how am I changing the world? Our friend Justin, when I'm trying to convince him to stay and work with me so that we can build this, what I ultimately had to do was say, this is the dream. And if you can find a bigger dream than this, go. But you can't, because this wheel and these cogs that are rolling this wheel is going to change the world. And that comes down to giving.
That's amazing. I'm going to ask you this. I've had the disease of people pleasing, and I think I'm almost cured, but I'm not always, I'm not all a percent, but it seems, as my perspective, it seems that you're unapologetic, and it seems in whatever you stand for, and that it just, you're doing your thing and you don't have time for the noise. Is that anything that you can speak to for young men that are trying to always fit in or trying to be the right thing or the somebody for somebody else? And how you've kind of navigated through that and become your own man.
Yeah, I mean, did Michael Phelps or Shugart and Gordon sit there and wonder, what is everyone else going to think when I swim this race? What is everyone else going to think as I'm sitting up in this helicopter looking down at my teammates at a crash site in Black Hawk Down, Shugart and Gordon, Medal of Honor recipients? Did that ever go through their mind? Absolutely not, right? They went out there and they weren't people pleasing. They were doing the right thing for themselves and for their country. And I use an Olympian and a Medal of Honor recipient because they couldn't be further from each other. Like, one's a pot smoking swimmer and the other two are Medal of Honor recipient Delta Force snipers. But the similarity is that, like, there's a degree of focus and determination and discipline and regiment that goes down to it. And like, we could pick up my phone right now and go to my direct messages on Instagram, and there might be, in this week, 24 military nonprofits asking me to do something for them. Can I please all of them? No. There's probably 200 messages in there about an individual. I'd be like, hey, I want to go into the military. I'm looking. Can I please all of them? Like, they're asking, can I post more workouts? Can I please all of them? No. But what I can do is be the best version of myself and have, then the net gain, the most positive impact in all of those things, and to be the most selfless version and the most high functioning version of myself to create the most amount of good and to be able to positively affect the most amount of things. I can't do that if I'm a people pleaser. So fuck people. That sounds really weird, where right. You're like, absolutely forget about pleasing them and you will be able to do more and the net positive will be so much more significant. Just go and be a badass.
All right. I have a personal question.
Okay.
You guys got a lot of tough questions.
I'm getting fired up right now. We're not just firemen. We're podcasters.
You're good at this.
That's high praise. I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. We live in California.
Mm-hmm.
All of my friends and family are leaving California. Is leaving California, and we know why. Like, I don't need to go into that. But I've always wondered this, is leaving California as a good, solid man and family, is that running away from the fight? Are we giving up? Are we quitting by moving somewhere else rad, like Texas or Tennessee or something? Or is it time to cut your losses and move on? How do you know the difference?
Dude, I don't know. You know, when you're looking at, was it Edmund Dawes, the Medal of Honor recipient that was a coward? In some regards, the guy that wouldn't carry a rifle into combat and climbed the cliffs and saved his pretty much in every single living body.
That's a great
in his
movie.
Unit.
Yeah.
Yeah. But a true story. He made a choice to try and save as many people as he could. And he lived and saved a lot of people. You know, we'll use a firefighter analogy. When you're looking at the fire as the wind shifts and you feel it in your face and the fire's in front of you, where is that fire coming?
Toward you.
Towards you. Should you stand your ground and dig a line? You know, no. You're going to burn alive, homie.
It's time to go.
It's time to move, man. You're going to have to make a choice. And sometimes you have to stand your ground. Sometimes there's fights that you as the individual can't win. But there's this protest. I think it was in Seattle. And there was one black man. As these protesters, ironically, it was a white guy at a BLM protest that was taking a chair and smashing a window, you know, to like fight capitalism or whatever he was doing. And this well-dressed well-mannered, well-postured young black guy walks up to this angry white idiot and just puts his hand on him. And you don't know what they're saying. You don't know what the exchange is. Behind the white man with the chair that he's smashing against a window is like another 500 angry people. And this was the beginning of it's about to be this massive riot. And one guy, one nobody walked up and stopped the whole, diffused the whole entire situation. Just like one woman in Afghanistan walked out and made a choice to stop what was going to happen. And she was the bridge. She was that stopgap between hell, fury, pain, and unimaginable horrors. And she just said, no, I'm going to stand my ground. Both of those could have gone a different way. That young black man could have been hit in the face with a chair and then stomped by 500 people behind him.
Yeah, that's actually very likely.
Yeah. So surprisingly, that's not what happened. So do I know what the right thing is for California? I love that place. I was born there.
It's
my
beautiful.
Family still, it's one of the most beautiful, and I've been everywhere.
Yes.
You know, from every beautiful mountain range I have been on. Every ocean, nearly every ocean I've swam in. Like that's
incredible.
Cool, that's a pretty cool thing to say.
That's pretty cool.
And there's nothing like California. There's not. And there's also nothing more unforgivable than what we have done in California. So I don't know, man. You have to do the right thing by your family first. And that's, you know, if you got God, family, country, that's number one. Number two is family. So country to include state is a very distant third for me. Like Texas is having some weird political changes right now as we have this huge infusion of people moving from California and New York.
Yeah.
And they're bringing the baggage with them.
Yes.
They're like, I'm fleeing this state. And they don't even understand why they're fleeing the state. They're doing it for economic motivation, capitalistic reasons. It's better. And for freedom. And but then they're coming here and be like, oh, we're going to do the same thing that we did in California and ruin it. And here in Texas, we're like, ooh, that's not a really good idea. Because now that you're on the outside looking in, look at the trash fire that is your state. And how do you fix that? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I don't know either.
So. I don't know. Yeah. But you got to do right by your family.
Yeah.
And that's not cowardice to make the right decision for your family. You're like, my kids are not going to go to school and not know what it looks like to have somebody smile at them because it's covered in a mask. That's just not going to happen.
The analogy makes sense to us, but Noel's got a 1-inch hose line standing at 50-foot flame lengths coming right.
You're going to burn alive, homie. Burn.
So you, you were talking about slow, and you were up in slow, and you trained at the Pit, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So back in the day, we used to do some boxing and some MMA stuff, and they had these DVDs, and we had gotten these DVDs that we were doing like straight up garage workouts with some guys that we knew with. And they had this one DVD of John Houckerman and Liddell and all these guys. And they had this workout at the very end called the Pit Blackjack.
Uh-huh.
Do you remember this?
I do.
Did you do this?
Yes.
So this has been this folklore thing for us for the last 10 years. We break people off with the Pit Blackjack.
Yeah. Have you ever been to the Pit in Arroyo Grande?
No.
Okay. It would make a lot of sense about who and what John Houckerman is if you ever go there. Like you drive into the coast, the ocean, obviously off to the west. And you kind of drive into the foothills. And in the foothills is kind of a libertarian preserve in these foothills, which is John Hackelman's little farm ranch area. It's not a lot of land, but it's a lot for California. And he has a cage built adjacent to a barn.
It's outside, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and he has a steep jacked up asphalt driveway and he has a stack of wheelbarrows.
Yeah, that's what everyone's wheelbarrowing up with rocks,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. With rocks and sandbags and sledgehammers. And, it's funny, the, dun, 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 dun. Not Rambo, boxing.
Rocky.
When he's fighting Drago, and Drago is the science, and he's getting the injections, and everything's like perfect to the. And then what's Rocky doing?
Throwing logs around.
Yeah, he's picking up a log, you know, and he's like punching a tree, and he's chasing a chicken. And when you go to Hackelman's, when you look at the blackjack workout, you're like, ah, I get it. He was one that embraced savagery early.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, because it seemed like you were in the golden era there, and it seemed like forever. If you looked at fighters back in the day, they got some road work into the morning. They didn't do a whole lot of weights, and it seemed like a lot of boxing and it was very lightweight. But then it seemed like Hackelman was the first to kind of blend CrossFit or whatever you want to call it,
yeah,
and that kind of stuff, which is now common. It's very common to see guys hitting tires and do different stuff like that.
Yeah, that metabolic conditioning, that fast twitch muscle, like how do I build, I'm going to hit you hard. That feels like a freight train muscle. Well, you have to do things that are like building your body to be a freight train. So that's a sledgehammer, and that is a tire, and that is an axe, and that is a wheelbarrow, where, you know, like Chuck Liddell hits you with his right hand, you're going to go to the ground.
Going backwards.
Yeah. You know, like, I get my hands on you, I'm going to put you on your ear. And that same type of stress, that same type of strength, like, you can only build through stress. And that's what we were doing at the pit. So, John was so far ahead of the curve. You know, he was an innovator and still is. He's a pretty neat guy.
So in our communities, fire service, military, law enforcement, those worlds, post-traumatic stress has been a thing for a long time, but at least I know in the fire service, it's becoming a bigger focus. Guys are realizing that it's a problem for a lot of people. I heard you talk recently about the way to deal with it is to do it, to deal with it before it happens,
yeah,
before
amen.
It becomes an issue.
Amen. Preach, brother.
Tell me why you think that.
Oh, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Something my grandma used to say, an ounce of prevention. So if you're doing something ahead of time that could prevent what is necessary to cure the problem, how much less effort it would take to have to prevent it from happening compared to trying to cure it. I'll use the Las Vegas shooting. That prick. I hope he burns in hell. What about a security guard that was turned on and switched on and watching this dude carry gun box after gun box up to his hotel room? And he's like, you know what? This looks kind of odd. I'm going to go and confront this guy and see what he's doing. Like, is that a little bit of effort? Yeah, it's a little bit of effort.
Might be inconvenient.
Yeah. Maybe makes me feel comfortable. Like, step out of my box to go and talk to an entitled white guy that is staying at a fancy hotel and, you know, has a nice room overlooking a really cool venue for music. Yes, that is a little bit of effort. The flip side, the cure was watching dozens of people die. Not enough tourniquets, a lot of people bleeding out. So the effort of trying to solve the problem, the disease of, you know, 100 some odd people down on the ground was just a tiny little bit of effort ahead of time. It's no different with PTSD. Like post-traumatic stress, how do you prevent having negative reactions to the stress that we see? I think it comes down to sleep, exercise, like the relationship that you have with your family. So you have a bandwidth that you're able to deal with stress. And if you're a jacked up person, you can't deal with a lot of stress. You know, but if you're a very developed, emotionally developed, physically developed, healthy person, your ability to handle all of these different variables just grows. You're a better version of yourself. So I want to be the best version to be able to handle the most amount of stress. When bombs are going off and people are screaming, I'm like pretty chill, you know? You could arguably say, I've seen a lot of horrible stuff. Like, why am I not a wreck? Like, why am I not suicidal and alcoholic? I mean, you pick up the bottle and you pull a cork, like you will be one. You don't get sleep. You don't have a good sex life with your wife. You're not healthy and exercising. You're not going to be able to deal with the type of stress. So why not be a healthy person before any of that stuff happens? So when that stuff happens, you're able to very in a healthy way process it. And that's all preventative stuff. Like, you can prevent all of the trauma that is going to happen to your psyche by the things you're going to have to do ahead of time before that incident happens.
Yeah, like if you were a binge drinker, you're on the red line, and then a traumatic thing happens to you, that could cross you over into alcoholism or whatever it may be. If you're aware of those things and you're putting in work and all those facets like you're talking about prior to, you're more resilient when that will inevitably happen to you of some traumatic event in your life.
We'll just talk dudes. Like, is alcohol a depressant or a stimulant?
Depressant.
It's a depressant, right? What does it depress?
your mood, your libido.
Literally everything yes. that has to do with being a man.
Right.
So like lower sex function. You will not get into recovery sleep. So it will lower your ability to do volumes of work. And the work that you do, you will not recover from because you're drinking. Lower libido, like not just testosterone levels, but actual desire to go and do things, lowered by drinking. Depression increased because it is a depressant. So like everything negative that could happen comes from alcohol. So why don't I just take that off the table? Can I have a glass or two of red wine at night? Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Like, is that good for your blood and your heart? Yeah, studies show for sure. Does it help with sleep? Is it a digestant? Sure. But if I have three glasses, okay, we've crossed the threshold. That's not doing any good now. Right? Can I sip on some bourbon? Like, if you want, if you like the taste, I personally am not a huge fan of it. Like, are there times where I'm like going to tip one up for a friend that I lost? For sure.
Absolutely.
At what expense? At what cost? Right? And could I play a video game and play on my computer into the hours of the night? Or could I walk in there, light a candle, put on some Marvin Gaye, you know, and make some magic? And that's going to start an awesome night of sleep. All the fantastic hormones that are going to be dumped in my brain, and like, I'm going to have the best night's sleep.
See, you know, I don't think people realize, or men realize, that it's cyclical, because you get drunk, you do not sleep. And then when you wake up in the morning, you eat like crap because yep. you did not sleep. And then you're not going to work out because you didn't sleep and you ate like crap. The opposite is true. And I think that we need to look at the cyclical nature of what we do, and all we do is process.
Yeah. Yeah. And that 1%, like, okay, do you have to stop drinking totally? No. But could you reduce by 1%? Like, do you like Cheetos? Okay. I don't personally want a Cheeto butt, but like, if you can't do without them, then maybe just have a little less. And then like, you can't give up fried food. Well, that's really dumb, but maybe just have a little bit less. And like, it's these slow improvements over time end up equaling a mad amount of change.
And anytime you make a change like that, you feel like you're giving up something that is important to you or that you really enjoy. What you realize is that on the other side of that is much more enjoyment and a lot more positive outcomes. And then in the end, you get rid of that thing entirely, pretty much,
yeah.
and then you don't miss it.
One of my favorite sayings is everything you want is on the far side of hard work. And like, so what do we want? Like, do I want good sex? Yes. Do I want success in my career? Yes. Do I want my kids to admire and appreciate and to love me? Yes. Do I want a good relationship and be a generous philanthropic person? Yes. So like, all of those things don't happen. It's hard work that gets you there. I mean, you like to just hit the nail on the head. So what is, can I apply hard work to sleep?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Can I apply hard work to exercise?
Absolutely.
Will that positively affect sleep?
Yes.
Absolutely. Well, can I put hard work and discipline and regiment into my sex life?
Of course.
Yes. Will that positively affect sleep, which will positively affect exercise? Yes. Can I put hard work into my diet? Now, like, to the cyclic that you're just talking about and the hard work that you're just talking about, all of those things interconnected and joined, complementing each other, and it becomes a true J curve. Like, it's compounding. And this exponential growth of improvement goes from 1% to 2% to 4% to 8% to 16% to 32%. And the next thing you know, you're like, you got jacked, you got a six pack, your wife is just foaming at the mouth for you to walk through the front door. All of your teammates are like, dude, that dude's on shift? Hell yeah. I don't know what happens tonight, but whatever it is, we're going to have a baller time. Dude, that guy's a badass cook too. Can't wait for him to get here. Like, all of those things, and the energy's fantastic. It becomes contagious, and then everybody else wants to do it. They want to hop on board. You know, they're like, that guy's surrounded by this guy. The guy knows this guy. This guy's going to train this way. And it just gets better and better and better and better and better. And then you look back at that lame version of yourself eating Cheetos, playing of an Xbox.
And who is that guy?
I don't know who that dude is. He was a loser.
You put in this work.
Yeah, you did it. You did that.
Let's go, Tim. I'm fired up right now.
I'm fired up. Let's go. Do this. Yeah, we got stuff to do today.
I'm fired up. I love it. I'm getting fired up because you can put hard work into all these facets of your life. And so let's go. Let's do this. And don't be afraid of that hard work.
No, don't. Embrace it. Love it. Embrace the suck. It's worth it. There's my one-year-old screaming at the door.
She's the cutest little thing.
Oh, she is.
She's awesome.
She woke up just so happy.
24/7. Look at her legs kicking right now. She's trying to make it in the door. So sweet.
I got one last question for you.
Yes, sir.
For the closer. Why do you own a minivan?
The tactical minivan is unstoppable. It's like the sniper and the ninja. You don't see them, but they can do everything that you need them to do. Are they functional? Yes. Could I go snag somebody off the Capitol lawn and nobody would ever suspect Tim Kennedy driving a van? Yes. And my kids don't bang other people's doors. So I like my truck. I have a pretty understated truck for as rad of a truck as it is. But I'm fairly certain that my truck would be dinged from my kids' doors. So it's a safety precaution, and it's the convenience and the tactical necessity.
That's fair. Every dad that I know that has bought a minivan has never looked back, and they
love
it.
It's the best.
So.
Well, now they hear Tim says, yeah,
yeah,
we're all
in.
Minivans are
going to
skyrocket.
64 miles to the gallon.
Yeah. Minivan sales are skyrocketing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's half electric.
Oh.
Yeah. And it has a medic bag in it, and there's a safe in it.
A minigun that comes out of it?
There's a safe in it.
Oh,
a gun safe.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we hit the acid bath today, and you broke us off. Yeah. Can you give us an idea of what we're hitting tomorrow?
Ooh, it's the Savage Barbarian. The Savage Barbarian, we will be working out Rogue American Apparel with Wes Whitlock. And he is a Marine that then went to work as a government contractor for some of the more nefarious and famous and infamous government contractors protecting presidents of foreign nations. This gym is a series of metal connexes out in the dirt.
At ass.
Yep. And we have chunks of cement that we use as our lifting apparatus. And we have cannon balls that have a hole gripped or drilled through them so you can grab the inside of the cannonball. So we'll be doing some shot puts with cannonballs, overhead throws.
Yes.
We'll be doing Atlas stone lifts. And have you seen Conan the Barbarian?
Of course.
All right. Do you remember when he walked up to the yoke and he picked it up?
Yeah.
So we have a Conan wheel.
Oh.
Yep.
The Conan wheel.
The Conan wheel.
Of course.
We have a Conan wheel.
Why not?
Yeah.
Looking forward to
there, and there will be machine guns that will just be randomly situated throughout. We'll be working out with Jeff Gonzalez, pretty famous Navy SEAL from Trident Concepts. Actually have his playing cards like sitting right here, right there next to that coffee cup. Do you see that playing card?
Yeah.
That says deck of pretty cool cards. And then my normal Savage crew.
Looking forward to it.
That'll be fun.
This has been super fun. Obviously, I just want to thank you again for allowing us to come into your home and hang out with you. This is really
best.
Cool.
It's going to be so much
fun.
Been
a great conversation.
Just wait for tomorrow.
And this has been the Fire You Carry podcast.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. God bless America.
Thank you for listening. We have our big fundraiser for the Fire Up program and Hold the Line coming up March 3rd. We're going to continue to give you more details as that gets closer, but remember to set that date aside on your calendar. We did just finish a special one-night version of the Fire Up program for basically the entire crew of 33s, which is one of our busiest stations here in the county. It was a rousing success. There was lots of snow and ice. It was just fantastic. So look forward to hearing a little bit more about that in the future as well. We really appreciate you continuing to listen. We'll see you next week.
You guys got a lot of tough questions. You're good at this.